Welcome back to the Western Bubble podcast. My name is Dario Hasenstab and I'm here with Balder Hagretz, and we are back from our summer break, a little bit longer than expected. We took off the summer for agenda and personal reasons, but Balder, I assume you're just as excited to be back as I am.
Hi Dario, yes, it's very exciting and it's been a wild summer, so we've got plenty to talk about there.
Absolutely, I mean, because I have been looking at politics now for, I would say, over a decade. And usually there's a nice little summer break for 2 months where, you know, politicians are on vacation, journalists are on vacation. So the most serious media item you're going to hear about is, I don't know, some fish eating a dog in a pond, right? Like these typical summer stories, or a lioness being on the loose here in Berlin, as happened last year. However, this year, I did not receive the summer break I deserved, in my opinion, because this summer was absolutely wild and there wasn't a break.
No, it was event after event, in part because of the permanent situations that we view in Ukraine and in Israel, of course. But also it seems that the world is very much in flux at the moment, right? It's so volatile. So many things are happening at the same time. And this traditional idea of quiet summers and then going back to business seems to be out of the window.
Because this is the situation we were already facing with our last episode before the summer, with the assassination attempt of Donald Trump. And that one to me seems like it was years ago, but it was really just a few months ago. And so we dealt with this thinking, okay, that is not really going to give us a calm summer. And Balder, the last time we spoke, Joe Biden was still the presidential candidate for the Democrats for the next US election.
And I remember ranting about this, like basically every reasonable person in the world, that we had two almost octogenarian men fighting it out, and Biden clearly no longer being capable to run a serious campaign, let alone be a president for another 4 years. In that sense, you know, the sky has become a little bit bluer and brighter, with at least Harris taking over, and at least we've got a person who's clearly in the right age group, clearly mentally and physically capable of fulfilling what's possibly the hardest job in the world. Now, of course, the question is whether she will still win the elections or whether Trump pulls it out of the back in the end.
Because this came all on the back of the debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And I remember watching it and just thinking, this is a bloodbath. This is terrible. And not because Donald Trump was so good or so sharp in the debate, but just because Joe Biden seemed genuinely confused. And I was a little bit worried for this man's health and just thought, where are his nurses? Someone needs to take this man off the stage.
It was painful to watch. It really was. And you're right in saying that Trump wasn't actually good, right? If it had been any other person he was debating, then all the media would have been about what a terrible debate Trump had. But in contrast to the bumbling Biden, he still seemed to be relatively okay. It's good that we can leave that behind us. So there is now a more serious choice. And I think that at the very least, this will lead to a lot of people actually being willing to vote, because it's hard to vote for a presidential election with Biden and Trump. One thing that I found fascinating in the reaction afterwards, and that we didn't have a chance to talk about before the summer, was that after enormous pressure and with the whole world knowing that Biden couldn't continue, he steps down. He says, okay, I have decided not to run. And from that moment on, he got treated like a saint. Like, what a brilliant sacrifice. Even though this had nothing to do with the sacrifice, it was just rationally, objectively, completely obvious that he had to go. But this is how these things work, right? So all of a sudden, he was glorified like a visionary leader, like a Mandela who could understand that what the country needed. And it wasn't him at that moment. Whereas in reality, he was basically pushed out because there was no other choice. However, I think the good thing is now that from now on, we can just talk about Harris and not worry about that anymore.
Well, actually, I do have a question about exactly this, Because so for right for transparency reasons, we've been on texting basis over the summer, but we haven't had our regular like hour long talks about the world.
I missed you, Dario.
I missed you too a lot. And one of the thoughts I had, one of the criticisms that actually came from the right side of the spectrum in the United States was for the democratic process, right, for the institutions that we always talk about protecting here in the Western bubble, was this concerning? Because you had a democratically kind of chosen candidate for the race, right, through the primaries that I know Americans put a lot of like emphasis on, a lot of effort on, and he was then basically removed by the elite, right, by a small circle around him. I mean, there's right the Obamas apparently played a role, right, Nancy Pelosi, Kamala, his wife. And that, I mean, obviously, commentators in the United States on the right side of the spectrum called this a coup, which I think we're very far away from. But when it comes to institutions and respecting institutions, something that we always talk about, was this 100% okay?
I viewed that debate afterwards, and you're right, it was especially the right, because basically Republicans panicked and they needed to frame this in some kind of way, because they would have loved to have Biden there, of course, because Biden was easier to defeat than Harris, for obvious reasons. I never really understood this, and feel free to convince me otherwise, but it would have been a problem if this had happened on, let's say, the 1st of December, a month after the elections, if Biden had been elected, and then all of a sudden, the establishment says, Harris got. But the fact that the Democratic Party had its primaries has nothing to do with democracy. That is a matter for the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is a private institution. It's not publicly controlled. Just like if a CEO gets moved out of a multinational, that is not a problem for democracy. It might be a problem for internal governance. So the fact that Americans, the United States system, has these primaries in this way, sets it apart already from many other democracies, right? That don't have any of these primaries. In many democracies, the leader of a party gets voted in through relatively backroom politics with very little power for the actual membership, right? So my argument here is that it would be a problem if the American people had voted, but that's not the case. Democratic members voted, and the Democratic Party is not a public institution, and I don't see how, therefore, it would affect democracy in any way.
Another spin that the Republican Party tried to put on this was that, well, if Biden is not fit to run for president, is he still fit to be in office now for the remainder of basically time? Is that a conversation we should be having in a serious one? Because, I mean, just a few days ago, Biden again made a terrible mistake, like at a press conference where he completely confused left and right again. And it was genuinely worrying about his state of mind.
It is a very serious conversation that, by the way, was also available to us a year ago already, because it's not that all of a sudden in the past few months Biden went backwards very quickly. It was a clear process, and in 2023 he already was very gaffe prone, and you saw the issues with his mental strengths and abilities. However, again, that is not a democratic problem. It's a practical policy problem. Biden was elected as president, and from a democratic perspective, it makes sense that he stays for as long as he wants until his term runs out, which is basically January 2025. If he chooses to step down, he can, of course. And I remember you and I actually had a bet about that 4 years ago, about because it was already clear that he was old. You know, it didn't happen overnight. And we had a bet about when he would step down or whether he would remain in power until the end of the term. Neither one of us thought that he would run for a second term. So this idea is basically, yes, that is a serious conversation to be had. I think it's a problem that he is president of the United States right now because of his age, and unfortunately the fact that he's one of the older 80-year-olds that you can find, right? I mean, there's some 80-year-olds that are still very energetic and capable, but apparently Biden less so. That's a serious conversation to be had, but it's not about democracy or institutions. It's simply about, hey, we want a capable person in the White House.
I really have to be careful about my bets in politics, because I have this flaw that I always see actors as too rational. And in an ideal world, I remember saying that I think Biden would have stepped down after a year or after two to Kamala to really like pave the way for her. And then when he seriously considered running again, I don't know. I need to stop betting on politics.
You owe me lunch because I won that bet. But it also is an indication of how already 4 years ago, it was obvious that there was an issue here, right? And basically the idea 4 years ago was Joe Biden is a fatherly figure who can heal the country, can bring the country back together, restore some normalcy to politics in Washington. You know, he's been around forever. He's generally respected by both parties, that kind of thing. So, hey, it is probably good from a healing process after the volatile Trump years to have him there. But surely he's only a placeholder and not much more. And yeah, the idea of him running for a second term was, of course, incredibly problematic and was very difficult to imagine 4 years ago.
Absolutely. And now we're looking at Trump versus Kamala, Kamala Harris. We already had the first and only debate between the two of them. And it's funny how perception changes, because now Trump seems like the old octogenarian who is rambling and doesn't seem to connect two sentences together anymore. I mean, this is from a European perspective in particular, this is an interesting observation, because I basically did not see him for 4 years, right? He got out of office. You sometimes read his tweets, but only now you kind of see him talking for longer than 2 minutes at a time again. And he seems to have the Biden problems now.
Of course. And it was just a matter of contrast and relative mental abilities that made it seem as if he was still competent and capable. And that's exactly why the Trump campaign and the Republican Party in general is panicking now, because the presence of Harris, who is, if you like, in her political prime, right? This is the prime age, late 50s, early 60s. That's the time that politicians are at the height of their power, their mental capacity, not necessarily mental capacity in, you know, absorbing information. We know that after 30, 40 years old, it goes downward. But in terms of experience, accumulation, and still being fresh enough to have a clear perspective. And that is an enormous contrast with Trump. So now all of a sudden Trump is exposed in that sense. However, I kind of doubt whether it has a significant impact on the electorate, because it seems that people who have decided to vote for Trump have decided to vote for Trump. It's not going to really change much. It just changes the media conversation a bit.
Absolutely. And I mean, the Kamala Harris campaign started off really, really well. I mean, you could see an immediate surge in the polls. And right, it's also funny how narratives change, because before Biden kind of stepped down, I actually do not remember any positive article on Harris whatsoever. Right, it was always like, you know, she's not really good with the voters. She didn't really handle the border crisis very well. And Kamala, you know, can't we find someone else? And he steps down and she steps up, and suddenly everyone loves her, and the entire half of the country seems to be absolutely jubilant about the fact that she is now stepping up.
And this shows clearly the problem with media and public perception, right? So Harris, by all standards, is not the most popular politician. She has a difficult past as district attorney. You know, at least for a lot of people, that's problematic. She was, you know, way too eager to lock up people for relatively minor crimes, going after, you know, the things that typically we sympathize with. As a vice president, she was essentially invisible. She just didn't seem to be there much, which is surprising given that Biden, as an older man, kind of gave a lot of space for other people to occupy, right? So it is then very telling that the moment that she is actually the nominee, that all of a sudden the mood swings. And this has everything to do with, first of all, clearly the media establishment and the people who write in newspapers, the people who speak on CNN and elsewhere, have a clear liberal bias and they don't want Trump to win. And so the way to make Trump not win is to make sure that Harris looks good. But on top of that, there's also the media bias of, hey, it could be that Harris becomes a new president and we better keep her on our good side. You know, you don't, as a journalist or as a newspaper, want to go against a potential future president, because that could really ruin your life, at least your career. Right. And so there is this swing that has nothing to do with analysis. The Harris that was criticized in, let's say, February last this year is still the same Harris that we see today. But our approach to her has changed because her position has changed.
I mean, that's actually one part we didn't talk about earlier when we talked about, right, the inner circle of the Democratic Party convincing Biden to step down. I mean, that's not the full picture, right? Because I assume that the media, the liberal media in the United States, must be high on power right now. Because, I mean, right, you had op-eds, like the New York Times editorial board, calling for Biden to step down, and an enormous pressure building up. George Clooney was also there, right, just dropping his name for attention. But so you have the media establishment really pushing against Biden and kind of getting the option they want. Well, then you also have to sell the option you were pushing for.
Yeah, now they're responsible for that. There's something similar. I don't know if it's exactly analogous, but there's something similar with war. So, for example, in February 2003, there was a real sense of concern and dislike for the idea of going to war in Iraq in the United States. The moment the United States actually goes to war, all of a sudden there's this enormous media mood swing, and it becomes about patriotism. It's about supporting the cause. It's about backing the troops who are fighting in Iraq. And the criticism about the actual invasion and war disappears for a year until it becomes clear that it's a disaster, and then it returns again. And that is kind of what you see here with Harris as well, right? So there is a lot of skepticism about her. But the moment that it's basically a done deal, then we want, or we, not me, but the establishment wants to ignore that skepticism and wants to just be a believer, because the stakes are too high in that sense. Obviously, if Harris becomes a failure, if either she loses the election or if as a president she fails, then in 1 or 2 years' time, the media will be on her like vultures again, obviously.
Absolutely. Now that you mentioned war, I think we have to talk about the other ongoing topic of the summer. And those were the actually, I think the only moments when we quickly texted about what was going on. And in a, right, obviously in a very cynical, almost satirical way, I think at some point texted you, I was like, I was promised Iran would start a war in the Middle East. Where's the war? No one has Iran hasn't started it yet. Right. So obviously kind of highlighting the, I don't know, ever increasing tit for tat between Iran and Israel. And the fact that whenever Israel attacks Iran in some form of way, it's okay, justified defense. But then when we're waiting for the response of Iran, it's basically, Iran is about to start a war in the Middle East, which is obviously very interesting from a narrative difference. But let's actually look at that. Right, the individual moments that led to all of this.
Yeah, because I think we can identify certainly three moments where exactly what you just described happened, right? Where three moments where all of a sudden, anyone can Google it if you've forgotten, where all of a sudden newspapers, general media, social media started saying, oh, we're about to have a regional large-scale war that could even erupt technically into World War III or something like that, right? And it was all had exactly the same structure of events. And of course, it all fizzled out because that war never came.
Absolutely. I mean, so, and see, this is how busy the summer was, because when we quickly talked about this in preparation for this episode, I was very surprised that the attack of Israel on the Iranian consulate in Damascus in Syria, where they killed basically commanders from the Revolutionary Guard Corps, so Iran's special military, I was convinced that happened this summer. Right? So this is how time perception kind of tricks us once in a while. But this happened in April, so on April 1st. And then I remember we were already waiting for a few days and even weeks for Iran to strike back. And there was always this like, oh, when is it going to happen? When are they going to throw the Middle East into war?
Yeah, well, when you say we, the media, I don't think you and I were waiting for that, because
no, not at all.
It was quite obvious. So this is the pattern that you see with this one and with the other two as well. Israel commits to an aggressive military, very aggressive foreign policy action, and we cannot emphasize enough how aggressive it is to hit a consulate in another country, right? In your own country as well, by the way. But so this was a foreign country for Israel, Syria. Now, Israel has basically been free to do whatever it likes in Syria. The world is not paying attention. Israel has struck Syria many times over the past few years. But to attack a consulate is one of the big, big red lines in international relations, right? And the reason for that is that international relations can only function if there is such a thing as diplomatic immunity. That might not always be comfortable, but there is a reason why the embassy of a country or a consulate of a country is that country's territory. So, for example, here in Madrid, the United States Embassy, which is a very big complex right in the center of Madrid, is U.S. territory. And the reason for that is that that gives safety for the United States to do its thing, and Spain can actually have honest, open conversations, communication with the United States, even during times of war. And this goes all the way back into history when international relations first started, because that's the only way that you can keep on talking to each other without fear. If you start killing ambassadors, if you start killing diplomatic personnel, then international relations falls into anarchy and it all collapses. So, going back to the 1st of April, Israel bombing a Iranian consulate in Damascus because there are Iranian military staff leaders talking about plans against Israel is not good enough, right? The fact that they were planning something against Israel is not an excuse to bomb a consulate because of the reasons I just gave. They did it. And then the pattern after that is, now Iran is going to start a war because Iran is going to retaliate and is going to be irresponsible. Instead of saying, Israel, you did something completely irresponsible. Let's hope that Iran is more sensible than you. Right? That would have been the proper response by the media and by analysts saying, well, if we look at the past, Iran has been relatively careful and relatively moderate in their aggression, trying to not escalate beyond what is kind of acceptable within this conflict that exists between the two countries. So Israel did something that falls outside of that scope. Israel did something incredibly irresponsible. Let's hope that Iran is the mature person in the room.
Yeah, I don't think we can stretch this enough, right? Is that you basically, as Israel, the state, like the government and the state of Israel, the military attacked Iranian territory, killing high-ranking military officials. That in itself is such an aggressive move that I feel like as the media needs to hold in and basically say, oh, okay, something serious just happened. But no, the focus immediately shifted towards what is Iran's answer going to be? Iran's answer is probably going to be disproportional, and they're going to be really stepping out of line because that's what they do. Obviously, they are the bad guys. We have been, like, we've been telling you for years. So let's see how bad their response will be. And then I remember we had to wait weeks until the response came. And that's right. That's the next step, is which kind of tells you a little bit about which of the two actors is trying to, like, avoid an escalation, right? By basically telling the Sunni Arab allies, hey, close your airspace. There might be an attack happening, right? Kind of sending all the signals to have Israel be as prepared as possible to kind of catch all the drones and missiles that basically then arrived later on. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really seem like Iran is the aggressor to me here.
No, well, so it's probably worth pointing out, lest people get confused by this, that of course it is true that Iran is a aggressive party in a conflict between two countries. Obviously, Iran is aggressively sponsoring groups such as Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen that have anti-Israeli agendas and that commit violence against Israel. And you know, this shouldn't have to be said, but obviously that is bad. Violence is bad. Sponsoring groups that commit violence or terrorist acts is not something that should be approved by anyone or should be accepted by anyone. However, what is important to realize here, that this is in a conflict where Israel doesn't directly necessarily sponsor groups, instead just simply strikes targets all the time, right? What made this special was that it was a consulate in Damascus, but Israel has hit Iranian targets in Syria and elsewhere all the time because Israel can get away with that more open type of aggression. So it's not that people should take away from this that we believe that somehow Iran are lovely puppies who don't harm a fly. No, Iran are very much actively engaged in an anti-Israeli campaign through terrorist groups, or at least groups that commit terrorist acts. I don't like the word terrorist group for many reasons. There is no doubt about that. But there is still some kind of balance of not escalating that conflict. And the problem is that these steps of bombing, for example, the consulate, is an escalation. And our psychological mindset goes then to, oh, but we think of Israel as sort of the peaceful or at least the reasonable state, and we think of Iran as this dark, evil, murderous regime, and therefore our concern is not that Israel did something to escalate, no, but Iran is now the one who's going to be responsible for the war.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for clarifying that, right? Exactly, like when I'm saying that who is the aggressor here, it's really about the situation of someone strikes and then someone is thinking about retaliating, right? But thank you very much for making that difference clear. Then we move on further, right? So now Iran retaliates by sending a bunch of drones and sending missiles.
And it is worth, excuse me for interrupting you, Dario, but it's worth pointing out that you mentioned they gave plenty of notice. So they actually called the countries affected airspace-wise. We are going to send drones and missiles through your territory. They gave a lot of time, not just for the Israeli Defense Forces to protect Israel, but also for the United States, United Kingdom, the Netherlands, and other countries to start protecting Israeli airspace, right? So, and Iran, it's not that Iran was just slow. Iran knew that that would happen, and that has been consistent with Iranian policy in the past, for example, with the assassination of Soleimani by the Trump administration.
Yeah, and I mean, not only Western allies are basically coming to Israel's defense, but Sunni Arab states as well, right? So Jordan, Saudi Arabia, they all participated in these efforts to kind of make sure that that the drones kind of heading towards Israel, that they would be shot down within their airspace, which kind of tells you that, right, there's a lot of actors in the region and none of them have any interest in escalation, which that's always nice to see that, you know, okay, there are what we can consider rational actors in international relations.
On top of that, absolutely, you're absolutely correct. But on top of that, Arab states typically don't mind Iran being in a bit of trouble, right? I mean, there's of course this sense. In many ways, you know, a country like Saudi Arabia feels that it sort of benefits them for Israel and Iran to just be at it together, because both countries are on the rivalry list of Riyadh and others.
Absolutely. And it's, I think, their behavior now the next few months down the line is actually very interesting to observe, because with the next two incidences that we're talking about, you actually see and hear announcements by particularly those countries, right? Jordan, Saudi Arabia, that, hey, this time we're not going to participate in protecting you because you have gone a little bit rogue. You have crossed a few lines that we're not comfortable with you crossing. And let's get to that right now, because then on July 31st, so right as I'm prepared to kind of go on vacation and thinking, oh, August is about to start, nothing bad can happen in this world. No, what happens is that at the inauguration of the new president of Iran, right, the political leader of Hamas was present in Tehran, in basically one of the locations of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And suddenly, a little explosion takes place, and the political leader of Hamas and his personal bodyguard are assassinated by an attack. And I mean, obviously, no one really takes responsibility for them. But with pretty high certainty we can say that that was undertaken by Israel.
Well, yeah, no, it very clearly was. The interesting observation here is that it almost flew a little bit under the radar of Western media, because there was this idea of Hamas leader, you know, whatever, terrorist, because that's the way that the West straight away frames it. And it is. But if you really think about this, let's think of an analogy. How about the Ukrainian defense minister visiting Washington? And then Russia says, we're going to have a drone strike against Washington to kill this guy. That would be absolutely seen by the United States as an open act of war. That would not be something that would be a minor thing. And then people say, but Ukraine is not Hamas. Well, it depends from your perspective, right? I mean, I agree, but it's not. This is exactly the event that happened. A leader was invited by a country, in this case Iran, is there and gets assassinated. That is an act of war. And once again, you see the media, who are so trained to think of Iran as the aggressor, to think of Iran as the threat, focus more on all the evil things that Iran was about to do, according to the media, rather than the actual incredibly escalatory, aggressive act of Israel.
These are the moments when, right, in the few days after, whenever an airline suspends flights over someone's airspace, it's like, oh, yeah, the Iranian attack is imminent. Lufthansa has suspended its flights. However, what we then actually saw is that Iran did not retaliate at all. And actually, what we then hear kind of like through the back channels is that this was part of the negotiation mass of a potential ceasefire between, in Gaza. I'm hesitant to even say between, because I wouldn't know between whom it is by now. But of a ceasefire in Gaza, of Iran saying, okay, our sovereignty was violated once again, right? We were attacked. But okay, in order for us to have a ceasefire in Gaza, we're actually willing to say, okay, you know what? Okay, Israel, you got one up on us. But if we have a ceasefire, this is going to be fine, right? So, I mean, and again, for weeks, I was promised by Western media an attack by Iran that would start a war in the Middle East, like a full-scale regional war.
Yeah, and it says a lot about our warped perspectives on how these things go. This is incredibly restrained behavior by the state of Iran. And it's not just a one-off, it is completely consistent with their behavior over the past years in other such cases. And so it requires for journalists and media to not want to be part of a moral narrative. Because of course you can make the case that there's a lot wrong with Iran. I mean, of course you can make the case that it is very much anti-liberal. There's a reason why I don't live in Tehran. But it doesn't matter what my moral perspectives are on Iran. What matters is how Iran behaves towards the rest of the world. What matters is what their approach is towards war and peace. And once again, this has been an example of one country, Israel, being wholly, wholly irresponsible in breaking the rules, the very basic foundational rules, and another country, Iran, being the responsible party that wants to look for some kind of, you know, non-escalation, some kind of solution where the violence gets at least limited.
Mm. And we see this behavior from Iran for now weeks. And again, now, I mean, right after, I would say like in the middle of September, you can also see the media getting a little bit tired of having to announce the escalation of the war every day. They're not having to come up with a different headline. And then suddenly towards the end of September, first you hear like kind of this announcement, this weird like news item of 3,000 pagers, which I had to Google at first, of 3,000 pagers exploding in Lebanon. And you're like, oh, okay, this can't really be a coincidence. This is not really a technical mistake. This has to be some form of orchestrated action by some foreign power. And okay, let's not look far, right? It's I would say also pretty clear that this was the Israeli Mossad, right? Their version of the CIA. And you have another yet very aggressive act, right? I mean, this time targeted at Hezbollah, right? So one of the kind of militias of Iran. And so I think the world is coping with this event. And suddenly then a few days later on September 27th, a massive bunker-busting airstrike hits the city of Beirut, the capital of Lebanon. And I mean, the estimates were that somewhere around 600 people died, right? But basically a whole building block is just dusted. And then suddenly, right, rumors spread around that, oh, maybe the leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, has been killed. We can't really verify it because allegedly he was down in a bunker 60 meters underneath ground. And he was, to kind of quote the bomb, busted out of that bunker, which kind of is another level of escalation, because that's an incredibly intensive bomb to use in a civilian area, right, in the capital of Lebanon, in Beirut, which is another act of sheer aggression, kind of towards, of course, Hezbollah, but like inadvertently also against Iran.
And once again, breaking that very basic Westphalian rule, right? It is something that, I don't know, if people who don't study international relations really recognize this sufficiently, that if you strip away all the conventions and all the international law and all the agreements that exist between countries that you could argue are voluntary, there is one key component that is at the basis of everything and that keeps the world from falling into entire anarchy, and that is you respect Westphalia. And not respecting Westphalia, like for example the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is a horrendous breaking of the rules and needs to be punished in some way. We don't want countries to break Westphalia because nothing else makes sense if we do. So every country has its territorial sovereignty, and you respect that. And now this is the third time, or at least in this period that you are describing, the third example of a attack against a perceived enemy, a real enemy, I guess, in the case of Hamas and Hezbollah, of Israel in a country that is not their own, in another Westphalian territory. And it seems that in the case of Israel, we just let it happen. Now, I've got an interesting little theory about how Israel looks at this, which is, my informed speculation, if you like. I don't know if you want to hear it, Dario. Always. because the thing is, if you look at Israel after its creation, it went, and with full support from the world, I think, went Nazi hunting. It went to Argentina and got Eichmann, for example, back. Basically, there were leaders responsible for the Holocaust who were still walking around, who had escaped Germany, and they were specifically in Latin America hiding. And the Mossad and other Israeli agencies went to catch them because they wanted to bring them to justice. I don't think that many people would have an objection against that. I mean, in the sense that people responsible for probably the worst crime that humanity has ever committed against itself, the Holocaust, you want to take those people responsible back to a place where they can be tried. But that in itself was already breaking of Westphalian rules. You can't kidnap, even if it's a Nazi leader responsible for such horrific things, you're not supposed to break the rules. And that is where Israel became very used to basically saying, we are special, we are a different country, the state of Israel exists for a different reason than, for example, the state of Spain. And we can break rules freely in order to achieve our goal of protecting, if you like, the Jewish state, protecting our people from future Holocausts and all that. And so with those initial steps, the psychology in Israeli foreign policy already got shaped. And that is the psychology that over time got consolidated, leading to Israel not even thinking twice about violating Westphalian rules these days in Syria or Lebanon or elsewhere.
Well, and I would say it becomes even easier to do that if, right, the very reason for your state existing is being kind of threatened by these groups, right? I mean, there's no secret that Iran will regularly say, we wish upon the death on basically the state of Israel. And let's be honest, this is the only reason for Hezbollah's existence. They were founded specifically with that target in mind. So then I assume this makes it very easy and there's less hesitance to do it against them, maybe than against other players that could also be perceived as a threat. But this doesn't take away from the fact, like, I mean, okay, if then Israeli media kind of talks about this, I'm fine with that. But this doesn't take away from the fact that Western media, who should have learned lessons from the last at least 20 years, is falling for that same thing, right? Is kind of enabling the state of Israel to do that, of saying, almost cheering it on. Because, I mean, with the first two strikes, there was a bit of, I think the West was a little bit uneasy with it. But with the strike on Beirut, I don't know. I at least you could kind of see a little bit of gloating, right? A little bit of, okay, it didn't hit the wrong person. Right? Yeah, I mean, that shouldn't be an excuse. It shouldn't be...
It's not about that. It's not about some moral... It's not justified when we really, really hate the person who gets killed. That's not how it works. It's not about, hey, is it a nice person that hasn't harmed anyone or is it a genocidal maniac? That's not what the system is about. The system is about protecting territory. And of course, that leads to uncomfortable situations. And you're absolutely right. Western media basically empower Israel in many ways to do this act of what I would argue self-harm, because that is the tragedy of all of this, right? It seemed the events that you've just described, and where Iran is kind of the responsible actor trying to calm things down, and again, responsible in not in a pleasant way, because they really should stop financing groups that commit terrorist acts, but responsible in the sense of not letting it escalate into complete disaster. In the result of all of this is that Israel has been engaging this past summer and arguably since October last year into one of the worst acts of self-harm and self-destruction that you can imagine. If you ignore the plight of the Palestinians, if you ignore the civilians that are now being killed in Lebanon, if you ignore the Westphalian system, whose rules are basically being flouted, just purely looking at the security and safety of the state of Israel and its citizens, this past year has been an absolute disaster. And that has been a voluntary set of policies by the government under Benjamin Netanyahu.
Absolutely. And simply because this is the Western Bubble podcast, I cannot let the West off the hook here, because particularly one country, speaking of the United States of America, should be standing on the sidelines, or maybe not even standing on the sidelines, but be more involved and say, hello, 23 years ago, we had a similar event happen to us. We had 9/11 happen to us. We couldn't really have any lessons. Maybe Pearl Harbor, but all right. So we couldn't really have any lessons. We lashed out and we engaged in two of the most destructive wars that we've had. And we lost trillions in US dollars. We lost countless lives. We killed countless people and we achieved nothing, right? So in theory, the collective intellectual heavyweight that the United States still is today should have written a very nicely worded letter. Dear Israel, we have seen this before. This is the Al-Qaeda playbook on 9/11. What you're planning on doing now is understandable from like an maybe psychological perspective, because you are hurt, right? You want to lash out. You want to kind of, right? You're the hurt animal that's cornered up. But that's not the way to go. Trust us, because we know. And no, the West decided to kind of stand on the sidelines and cheer them on and be like, yeah, come on here. And we'll finance it and we'll support it. And I mean, Israel has basically used almost like a salami tactic over the last year of kind of stepping, like taking one slice out and kind of increasing the escalation level to a level where then on October 1st, they invaded, They invaded Lebanon, because Western media did something very interesting here, right? It was the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yeah, but it was the Israeli incursion of Lebanon. Those are two separate things.
Special military operation.
That's what I, right? That's what I called it. For an entire seminar, I called it the Israeli special military operation, just to kind of show how absurd all of this is right now. But can you believe it that it basically only took a year of kind of us numbing down to violence that then Israel suddenly invading Lebanon?
And this is the entire tragedy from a Western perspective as well, right? So if you think of the West as sort of the... Well, let me say, the West themselves see themselves sometimes as like the protective parents of Israel. I mean, you know, it came out of the British Empire. It was the British who created Israel in the shape that it was supposed to be in the beginning, in the 40s. And the West basically wants to moderate Israel because sometimes, like, you know, like you look at sometimes an angry teenager, hey, calm down, don't do anything crazy. You know, but in the end, we'll always have Israel's back. We'll always support Israel at a fundamental level, because that's what you do to your child. And the problem with that is that that kind of blind basic support, despite some calls of moderation and, hey, could you please not kill too many civilians, etc., etc., that fundamental support that is unwavering leads to Israel being allowed to harm itself to no end. I mean, at some point as a parent, you have to draw some clear line and you have to say, now, my dear beloved son or my dear beloved daughter, you're doing things that you're going to regret in the future, that are going to be terrible for you, that are going to hurt you in the long run and hurt many other people. Could you please stop it? And if you don't, I'm going to take other types. I'm going to call the police because something is wrong with you. And the West is not capable of taking that step. They keep on sort of asking Israel, could you please be reasonable? Could you please calm it down? But they're letting Israel harm and potentially actually even destroy itself in the long term.
I disagree a little bit with how you ended that analogy, because it's the West is not only not asking Israel to do that, no, it's also giving Israel, the teenager, a knife and money. To basically do what they're doing.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Yeah, if you really, I haven't thought this through properly, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, so but that's exactly that kind of behavior, right? A parent that calls their child and says, "Hey, I don't really approve of what you've been doing. I'm worried about you. I think you're doing the wrong thing," but doesn't say, "If you don't stop, I'm going to cut you off." Doesn't say, if you don't stop doing what you're doing, I'm not going to send you any more money. I'm not going to. And if you continue and you become a threat to your roommates or someone around you, then I'm even going to call the police, because it would be better for you to be restrained for a while, calm down, and see what damage you're doing towards yourself, regardless of any damage towards others. And the West, in that sense, is a very weak and ineffective parent towards Israel.
Super ineffective parent and actor. And that's it. Now we are on October 11th. That's the day of recording. Things have not gotten better. And I mean, so one of the things we discussed at Raya a few days ago was also the factor of timing, right? Because so we've just had the 1 year anniversary of the 7th of October massacre. We have the US elections coming up. And honestly, we have become incredibly numb to violence in general since basically February 2022. Right, there's now two wars happening. I mean, Walter, we haven't even spoken about Ukraine a single moment. I think we've mentioned it, but we haven't really spoken about Ukraine. And we're already talking for 15 minutes. I mean, this is how crazy the world is, that we talk for 15 minutes about Joe Biden, and then we spent another 35 minutes talking about Israel and, okay, what the hell is happening in today's world?
No, absolutely. It is important to remember that as we're speaking right now in Ukraine, Russian and Ukrainian soldiers are dying and nobody seems to be paying attention, including ourselves. And this is a very scary observation. There is something inherently chaotic and anarchical about the world in 2024, where there are all these dynamics that we can't easily control, that are difficult, that are complex, all these things going wrong, and kind of to protect ourselves from going crazy, going mad, we like to, you know, just basically pretend that it's not that bad, like to pretend that when children die in Lebanon or elsewhere, that, you know, it's part of life. And that numbness, that lack of connection with the violence that we, our societies are partially responsible for, bodes very badly for the future. And I'm afraid to say it bodes well for our podcast, because there will be plenty to talk about in the next few weeks and months because of that.
This seems like a very depressing moment to end today's conversation on the last 2 months that we missed in international relations. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
I chose a quote by Alexis de Tocqueville, who of course was a French philosopher, author, who traveled extensively through the United States and was part of sort of the French philosophical movement that supported US independence and US democracy being established in connection with the Founding Fathers. And it's particularly apt, this quote, because it kind of refers back to your analogy with 9/11 and the war on terror versus Israel. It is about learning lessons from the past or not. And the quote goes, "When the past no longer illuminates the future, the spirit walks in darkness."